Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about the features that make up a dynamic economy. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Edmund Phelps. Professor Phelps, winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Economics, is the director of the Center on Capitalism and Society at Columbia University. Professor Phelps has written books on public debt, inflation, unemployment, rewarding work, indigenous innovation, and the good life. He has also published texts on economic justice, political economy, and the various schools of macroeconomic thought. While his areas of research are vast, he will tell you that his work can be seen as a lifelong project to put people as we know them into economic theory. Today, we will be discussing Professor Phelps' most recent book, Dynamism: The Values That Drive Innovation, Job Satisfaction, and Economic Growth. The research in this book puts to test some of the arguments made in one of his prior books, Mass Flourishing, a text where Professor Phelps remarked that the caveman had the ability to imagine new things and the zeal to create them, but a culture of liberating and inspiring dynamism is necessary to ignite what Lincoln called a passion for the new. Today, we aim to find out what exactly are those features that help inspire a dynamic economy. Professor Phelps, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to do this show. Happy to talk about those two books.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for taking the time. We're very happy to have you on today. Our conversation today is primarily going to be centered around dynamism, what it is and what it means for all of us. I would imagine that it's clear to most of our listeners that one of the key components of building a dynamic economy is finding ways to harness innovation. But in order to do that, I think we first need to understand what exactly constitutes a dynamic economy, how we should interpret the concept of innovation, and the ways in which the two interact. We also need to understand how we should go about measuring innovation, which isn't entirely straightforward. But you know, these are the things we're going to get into today. But before we do all of that, why don't we have you talk a little bit about why you chose to write a book on dynamism, and maybe touch on some of the gaps that you found in the existing literature?
Well, I and my teammates, I guess you'd say, let me name them, Recha Bojilov, Gilfi Zuega, and Jan Takun. Our mission was to test the ideas that had come up in the course of writing the book Mass Flourishing. So it's a little hard to talk about one without talking a little about the other. But yeah, we got to be clear on the definitions. I myself was a little murky at first about what I mean by this term. And what I usually say now is that the notion of dynamism it is a nation's capacity and willingness to innovate. And indigenous innovation is innovation that bubbles up from people working within the nation's economy. And those two concepts are to be distinguished from exogenous innovation that comes from who knows what, whether it's the applications of the findings of scientists or the findings of explorers in their discoveries. Let me just give a tiny bit of history here. I think it's sort of interesting. What the neoclassical theorists like Arthur Spiethoff and Gustav Kassel and Joseph Schumpeter, all of them in the German historical school, but not all Germans. What they got wrong is that they failed to recognize the capacity for innovation is not limited to discoveries made by scientists and navigators. Far from it. Most innovation, better ways of producing something, or better products to produce, were conceived, were hit upon by people, often ordinary people, engaged in their work. And that's my main theme. And the hard work is expounding it and finding the vocabulary with which to express the ideas. At some point, one of the goals in my career became the idea of putting people as we know them, their expectations and their creativity into economic theory. It became apparent to me that most ordinary people possess the creativity which can lead to better products to produce and better methods or ways to produce them. I discuss how I came to this realization in my forthcoming memoirs, by the way. It's called My Journeys in Economic Theory. And that will be out. It's taking forever, but it's supposed to come out in May.
Well, we look forward to that.
Me too. All right. That's a windy introduction. Shoot. Now your questions.
Yeah. So one of the elements that must be understood early in the book is the concept of total factor productivity, TFP. And that can be a difficult concept, even for many economists to wrap their heads around. So to help, I guess, our listeners out, and to get a handle on TFP, can you provide us perhaps your definition of total factor productivity and maybe talk a little bit about how it interacts with economic growth?
TFP is an abbreviation for total factor productivity. Now, for a non-economist, that's a forbidding notion. What on earth does that mean? Well, now it's a compound of labor's productivity and capital's productivity. You put them together, where they are found in the world, in some country, it has a certain amount of labor and it has a certain amount of capital. And the product that comes out of that mix of labor and capital, that per unit of labor and capital, is the productivity of labor and capital. Not just the productivity of labor, not just the productivity of capital, but it's the productivity of the total, the sum total of the two, labor and capital.
Right. So what are some of the explanations for differences in total factor productivity between countries? It seems that we here in the U.S. have been quite fortunate with regard to TFP. Do you think that we've been relatively lucky, or do you think that we've really figured out a better way to harness TFP?
Here's where we come to innovation. If there's no innovation, then total factor productivity is going to be stagnant, stationary, unchanging. In other words, if there's nothing jarring the economy or nothing lighting it up like innovation, then labor productivity and capital productivity and this mix of the two, total factor productivity, will just be stagnant, just sitting there. And you may have an increased population, which will induce increased investment, but total factor productivity is not going to be enhanced by just being bigger.
So do you think that we have figured out a better way to harness it than other countries?
I think so. I would though say that America has a better track record of being willing to attempt innovation and to be successful in those endeavors. So the United States, and to some small extent, three or four other countries have pushed up, have driven up TFP levels in all of the countries where that innovation was going on. And all, of course, even nations that weren't doing any innovating, they can piggyback on the advances in methods that they see by just looking at, by taking a trip over to look at the countries where the advances are occurring.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Do you think it's possible for a country to have sustained growth, do you think it's possible to have sustained growth even with low in indigenous innovation? For instance, can countries simply import innovative technologies rather than?
Sure, right, absolutely. The United States doesn't have very much to import from. They can't find very much to import from the. That's not true. If you put all the countries of the rest of the world together, probably their innovations would be comparable to the U.S. innovation. A country's TFP is going to grow because of its own innovation, but of course also as a result of the innovations being made in other countries. But of course, the U.S. is heads and shoulders, the leader. In innovation.
Do you see the U.S. continuing to lead in innovation, or do you think some other states around the world will charge ahead of us in the coming decades?
It would be great to see the U.S. Continuing to be ahead of the pack, in front of the pack. But, there's no natural law that ensures the continuation of that. Just looking at some data in the past couple of days, and hadn't been aware of how well Finland was doing in the 70s and 80s. I knew they were very clever and creative, but I didn't know the size of it. Denmark, Australia, a lot of those countries that we don't think of very much are clever ducks and rather creative. So if we stopped innovating here in the U.S., and we almost have stopped, there are still some sources of innovation in other countries. But I'm not sure I answered your question. Do I expect to see the U.S. Continuing as a leader? I think that if one country is going to spurt ahead tremendously over the next few decades, it would be the U.S. But whether the U.S. is going to make it, or whether the U.S. and the other leading innovators are going to do well in the near future is I think very much in doubt. I know you can't pick up the TV without hearing somebody extolling the magical stuff that's going on in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is just a tiny part of the economy. So even if they have high rates of innovation, they're just that little thing sitting there. The whole economy benefits from the advances they are making. Don't misunderstand me, but can't have the rate of innovation that we had in America from around 1870 to around 1970 to 1970 without having innovation all over the place. There's been a tremendous drop off in innovation over most of the economy.
Yeah, you talk in the book about the slowdown in TFP after 1970. How do we explain that when there's been a continued increase in GDP per capita? Do you think that we are in the middle of an innovation decline, or is it simply that TFP is becoming less important for achieving growth?
Innovation is very basic, but if innovation stops suddenly in the U.S. and in the others, these countries would continue making, for a while, would continue making new investments in the economy to exploit the opportunity created by recent innovations in the past. The rate of return on such investments has fallen to a level that doesn't allow for any more investment expenditures on top of what they've already done. It's very hard to say where the U.S. is right at this moment, because COVID-19 came along, and then the tremendous government actions to respond to that. My God, it's as an academic economist, I'm praying for the day when there's a normal year, and I would love to look at the data then. Otherwise, I don't see any hope that we can see much in the data for 2021 and year 2022. Maybe after the smoke clears, we will find that growth of total factor productivity is as bad as we thought it was.
Yeah.
Or we might find that it's worse than we had realized. I don't know which way to jump.
Well, let's take a step back for a bit. What do you view as the roots or prerequisites for harnessing innovation? And are there things that governments can do to ensure that those characteristics are present in the economy and remain present in the economy?
The way I see it is that the modern values, are the fuel for innovation, and in turn that dynamism drives economic growth. Modern values can be traced back to the humanism of found in the Italian Renaissance, among artists like Cellini and Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. I know nobody's ever heard of him these days. But in Oxford, not so many centuries ago, he was a god. There were two gods at Oxford, and Pico was one of them. So much for Pico. Well, and then later, among later writers, there's Voltaire and Cervantes, philosophers like Hume, and during the Enlightenment, and among 20th century philosophers like Henri Bergson and William James. So this ferment of new thinking, this new spirit, this new grasp of what we're capable of doing. And that was an enormous driver, I think, when innovation got going, really got going big time in Britain in the 1860s, and the US was maybe just a few years behind towards the end of that decade. Here, Lincoln wrote of his travels in that year, and he said he was just amazed at people's excitement over new things.
Right.
So, remarks of Lincoln. We don't have good data on those years. The remarks of Lincoln speak volumes. Something was big was going on.
Right.
Towards the end of the 1860s. And now we begin to have data in the 1870s. And then it jumps to Germany and France and so forth and so on. These are the countries that had a good background that would propel efforts to innovate. So the wellspring of all this is the values that were created by these new thinkers. Let me just say that I classify the modern values into three categories: individualism, vitalism, and self-expression. I'd like to take a moment to talk about them because it's so important.
Sure.
I think people often confuse individualism with selfishness. I was not using the term individualism in that sense, and I don't think most people would. By individualism, I mean using one's own judgment, thinking for oneself, and rejecting conformism. And then another important value is vitalism. It's characterized by the zeal that can be found and experiences like overcoming challenges, personal growth, and voyaging into the unknown. Lastly, there's the self-expression of the satisfactions of using one's creativity, of achieving things. Now, you asked me in your advanced description. You ask about some things the government can do to ensure these values, to ensure that they are present in society. I think one thing is reintroducing into secondary and higher education the main ideas that I just identified. By the way, as a freshman going into Amherst College way back in 1951, I was required to take a 2-semester course in the humanities, which had an influence on my thinking the rest of my life.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, 10 or 20 years ago, I was taking a trip to Amherst to participate in something, and I discovered that around 1960, Amherst College abolished that course. There are not very many universities left who have it. Columbia happens to be one where I was a teacher for 50 years, not 500 years. It feels like 500, but 50 years at Columbia. Can you imagine?
Wow.
What, 10 years at Yale and Penn. for a total of 60.
Wow. So that's it's
I was right. I'm staggering at the effort. My God. Yeah. Okay. So one thing is getting those values back. But there's another problem, I think, about innovation in the U.S. There's been a rise of corporatist thought. Almost nobody on this side of the Atlantic has the faintest idea what that word might mean. But corporatism, corporatist system replaces competitive markets of capitalism with government rule over the initiatives taken by corporations. Mussolini's Italy in the 1930s was an example of a corporatist country. You know, you don't want an economy in which you don't give free rein to which the main show is the free rein of individuals with new ideas. You don't want corporations being shunted off or shuttled to do this or that for the government, or not to do this or not to do that. You don't want that. And I think that the heavy hand of a government it perhaps could be is, I think, another real consideration, real force. Nobody's really done the work on this yet, but going to be hard to measure, but I think that's an important matter. Time and resources must go into communications between Washington and the heads of government, the heads of the big corporations. I'm sure the corporations are trying to get the governments to do this. The governments are trying to get the corporations to do that, and it's not a very good environment for innovations springing up from new ideas and the people.
When we think about the importance of innovation and how vital the individual is, what are the traits or skills that people need to possess to become innovators themselves?
I argue that dynamism is of people. In the book, in Mass Flourishing, I talk about the dynamism of the economy. I'm going to think that was a bit of a mistake, careless mistake on my part. I was really talking about the dynamism of the people.
Right.
I argue that the dynamism is generated by the deep set forces that I was just talking about, the drive to change things, the things that come out of those values, the drive to change things, a receptivity to new things, and above all, a readiness to imagine and to create. As I say, things that I think derive from modern values. Some gratifying results emerged in the book, Dynamism, from my co-author, Gylfi Zuega's statistical investigation of the force of values, as we called it. Using the method of canonical correlations, never mind with that, created by somebody whose name was Harold Hotelling, professor of statistics right here at Columbia, in the 1930s. Using his method, Gylfi Zuega, he found that certain values matter for, or certain traits matter for economic performance, such as trust, the willingness to take initiative, the desire to achieve on the job, teaching children to be independent. I didn't explain this very well. The folks who measure attitudes of peoples, you know, the people, they have what their ways of asking questions at the household door, and you know, they'll ask a question like, well, with regard to your children, do you teach them to be independent? You know, so you can get from these surveys, you can get a sense of which of these forces are important, and maybe some of the forces are found not to be important, and some of the forces might be found to have be antithetical to innovation. Anyway, Gylfi Zuega's finding was that these forces are pronounced, and they are pronounced in the household survey data. Looking across countries, those values correlate rather well with the strength of innovation in those countries. Not sure if I hope I answered your question.
You did. And what was interesting from your answer is it seems that perhaps the rowdy child may be more important to the long-term health of the economy than the obedient one.
Oh, probably so. Yeah. Maybe it could go too far.
Well, you touched on it a little bit earlier, but I do want to sort of revisit the tech sector's impact on innovation. In the book, you say, it is true that Silicon Valley has created high-flying startups that rely on technological advances in computing and telecommunications. But apart from a brief episode in the late 1990s, the contribution of these companies to the economy as a whole has been minor. Why do you think the growth in indigenous innovation declined during the IT revolution? And I guess secondly, do you think that the idea that IT is the engine of the U.S. economy, or at least that that Silicon Valley's influence is particularly large, do you think that that is something that perhaps we need to rethink?
Oh, well, I didn't mean to say that Silicon Valley's contribution is weak compared to other industries of the same size in the United States. I wouldn't argue that indigenous innovation declined during the IT revolution. And I certainly wouldn't have meant to say that indigenous innovation declined because of the IT revolution. What I was driving at is that the IT revolution was a kind of an exception. It has not shown itself to be widespread over the whole economy, or it's not, it didn't turn out to be, if it was ever thought it would be, a solution to the problem of slow economic growth. Problem with focusing on Silicon Valley is that it's like that idiom about putting all your eggs in one basket. It's just too narrow. Recovery from slow growth would, by the country as a whole, would require, I think, not just innovation coming from the creativity of a select few in a certain industry, but rather widespread innovation. Widespread innovation requires a diversity of creativity and ingenuity and the perspective of ordinary people across many industries. Everybody's got to be pulling on the wheel, on the boat or whatever. Think there's been any indication of any recovery of the growth of TFP, growth in common parlance? I don't think there's been anything like back to normal there. We still have very slow growth, and that's going to continue as long as innovation is found only in a tiny part of the economy.
Yeah. Do you think that you know, we often hear about workers who have been left behind as a result of some of the shifts that have taken place over the past few decades, whether, you know, those shifts are the result of increased globalization or changing geopolitical landscapes. Do you think that perhaps one of the reasons many Americans feel that they've been left behind is because they have been casualties to slowing innovation?
Oh boy, that's been a theme of mine. Try to get it published in what was it, Atlantic, I think. They were totally uninterested in it. I guess I picked the wrong magazine. To the disgruntlement of a wide range of people, the envy and much of their envy of those few people who have gained some ground. That's I think has got to be laid to the slow growth, and the slow growth has to be laid to the things we're talking about. Mostly a loss of the right values, but there's also this governmental stuff that we were talking about. At time, we probably could think of some other forces, but I think those are the important. Those are the important forces behind the continuing slowdown.
Sure. Yeah. I want to get your thoughts about the robotics age. You know, many of our listeners here at the demand side are concerned with the impact robots are having on the underskilled segment of our workforce. How have robots impacted innovation and TFP thus far? And should workers be worried about the future?
In the book, Dynamism, another co-author, I mentioned Gilfie before, but this one is Hyun-Tek Hoon. So Hyun-Tek Hoon presented some theoretical findings on two types of robots, additive and multiplicative. Additive meaning robots that substitute for human labor, and multiplicative robots that those are the ones that augment that empower human labor. He finds that while the immediate impact of the arrival of multiplicative robots is to cause the stock of conventional machines to fall, the real wage need not fall because of the offsetting labor augmenting effects of the robots. Another result of his is that in a two-sector model of the economy, additive robots spur investment in conventional machines, which stimulates innovation and thus growth.
Well, I guess to wrap things up, I have one last question for you, Professor. If there is one point that you want the readers of Dynamism to take away, and perhaps policymakers as well, what is it?
Well, I think it's the 2 points I made before. Values are so important, and I think there's been a decay of the right values in the West generally, but I think most conspicuously in America, sad to say, there's been a decline of values. And then, maybe not unrelatedly, there's been problems rising up in the relationship between the government and industry. Governments, I think in West countries generally, governments have spread their influence very widely, and I think that's different. Values and the nexus between government and industry. I think those are the two that shorthand is corporatism, but it's more complicated than that. Those are the two kinds of things I think that are prominent in narrowing the innovation that takes place in America.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know our listeners and I have learned a great deal from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Real pleasure to talk with you, and I'm glad that if I was able to explain some of these oddities and conundrums to you, I'll be very happy about that.
Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our very special guest, Edmund Phelps. Make sure to check out all the episodes of the Demand Side on the Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.